paying for a safer city and developing downtown. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5 for First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead this hour, Mayor Lenny Curry's budget priorities for Jacksonville and how the city will pay for them, plus your calls. Join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, marking the 50th anniversary of the moon landing coming up this weekend. All of that and more just ahead. But first, this hour, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry presented his proposed budget Monday to the Jacksonville City Council. Curry is focused on public safety and economic development.
A few months ago, I made a promise to the people of this city that they won't recognize downtown in 4 years. I stand by that.
So Curry's $1.37 billion budget is not only bigger than last year's, but he says the city can pay for all of his priorities without raising taxes. What does that mean, whether it involves funding the new Cure Violence initiative or beefing up downtown so much so that, as the mayor says, we won't recognize it in a few years? We're beginning the hour with a closer look as we welcome John Delaney, former mayor and president emeritus of the University of North Florida. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, Daniel Cronrath, professor of political science at FSCJ. Good to have you, Daniel.
Good morning, Melissa.
And we want your calls. What are your thoughts about the mayor's priorities for the next 4 years of his term and his new budget for the city? It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Our Facebook page is open as well. Let's begin with former Mayor Delaney and President Emeritus of UNF. What do you think of Curry's budget overall?
I think it was a good budget, and it's up 4+%. I used to use as a metric, you know, inflation plus population growth is sort of a gauge of where it fits. He's going big on public safety, and clearly you could sense emotionally that was a big deal to him. And I think every mayor in the country wakes up thinking about economic development. How do we make the town better and people have better jobs? And he's got a lot of good stories to tell on that as well.
Okay, the mayor's saying in 4 years we will not recognize downtown Jacksonville. Let's talk about what that might look like, Daniel Cronrath.
Well, I mean, I think the first thing is, will that be because we're missing buildings or because we're adding amenities? We were talking about before, you know, when you drive in right now and you come down Bay Street, if you haven't been down Bay Street and you see where the city has put sod over the sites of the former City Hall Annex and the former courthouse, you, in my mind, driving in today, I could really see the potential of the city. I think the biggest question now is, how do we redevelop downtown? And quite frankly, while this is a really solid budget for the mayor, and I think he just addressed a lot of needs, there's not the kind of money in this budget that you're going to be able to see to do, some sort of historic relaunch of our downtown. The funds aren't there for it. And of course, in just another month, we're going to have, more greenscape with the removal of the landing.
Okay. And the mayor has taken criticism for plans to demolish the landing, other buildings that have come down and are now empty lots. There's now more empty space than occupied space in downtown Jacksonville. So if you're an urban core advocate, clearly we've got a long way to go to have the kind of thriving urban center that other cities of this size have. John Delaney, what about that? Because for those of us that work downtown and spend a lot of time downtown, we see the empty lots and we've heard the criticism from people who don't like this perception that buildings are being brought down without a plan in place for what's going in there next. What about that?
Well, I like the idea of green space in a downtown. I think it's a positive and adds values to the buildings that are surrounding it. And I think the landing, some of the preservationists would like to see if that can be converted. I like the idea of some green space there.
You'd like to see a park there.
Yeah, I think it's because you don't really have that there. One of the problems with downtown is it's like 3 miles long. I mean, it's a really, really wide downtown. And so you've got to kind of have a broad impact. I had always liked in the shipyards the idea of a riverfront park for that whole stretch along there. And I think he's going to have the mayor is proposing or talking about a river walk and then green space and then, building retail and residential behind it. He's clearly staking a reputation, his reputation on downtown. And, you know, that doesn't poll well. That's not a popular thing to bet on. And, you know, when he goes into these things, he goes all in. He did it on the pension plan and that kind of a thing. It's a take no prisoner sort of a thing. So I anticipate downtown is going to look a lot different in 4 years. And I think far for the better.
And specifically, we are watching a few projects like the planned development around TIAA Bank Field, Lot J, what Shad Khan and his company wants to do. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, that's the move now. You see it in Dallas and Atlanta and some other cities, is to make it really an entertainment district. And, you know, I'm hearing it's somewhere between $300 and $500 million. That's an awful lot of money to put in there. And some hotels and those kinds of things. And when you start to get that energy, I can remember in the 2000s when we'd come out of, really the recession didn't hit Jacksonville that bad, the 2000 recession, thinking, oh, geez, maybe we should buy a condo or something or other downtown. You get some enthusiasm that builds. And I think people are starting to think that again. Hey, you know, maybe this is a place to invest, maybe a place to live. Millennials like the idea of living downtown and being able to walk or bike ride as opposed to drive.
You're the former president of UNF. Daniel, you teach at FSCJ. All four of the universities in Jacksonville are making plans to put more students downtown to live, work, play. How do you see that affecting downtown growth?
Well, I think that, you know, there are two commonalities in my mind as you travel across America or really anywhere in the world, you know, what constitutes a great city. And there are two factors in my mind. One is college kids, and two is green space. It's you know, any city that you go to that you would call a great American city has both of those facets at play. And, you know, in the 21st century, people are interested in quality of life indicators. They don't want to move to a downtown area that doesn't have green space. It doesn't have a spot for them to walk their dog on a daily basis if they have a condo. And when you talk about the economic drivers, I mean, I hate to say this, but I think at one time we were all in college, and the one thing that most college kids have in common is they spend every dollar in their pocket, which is something what our downtown—
and sometimes way beyond college.
That's right. which is something our downtown could use, is that kind of, you know, folks who are out there who want to, you know, insert money into our restaurant scene, who want to insert money into our boutique retail scene, and— You know, that's the kind of energy and that's the kind of drive that downtown needs. And I think you'll see that. I think that's manifest in most of our great cities. And I think Jacksonville can be that.
The mayor wants to, he's saying he's 100% committed to making downtown the heart of this city and taking bold actions to do that. He's putting about $73 million into infrastructure needs, which Jacksonville really does need badly. Everything from drainage to road safety improvements, dock redevelopment, all kinds of projects going to infrastructure. That's not sexy necessarily, but when it's not shored up, you notice it.
Yeah, Daniel and I were talking about this before we went on air, that it's hard to make these budget addresses sexy because it's numbers and you've got to shift topics. It's hard to find the transitions between the topics. But you could always put more money into infrastructure, and I think he's targeted it, you know, pretty doggone well. If I can go back to Daniel's comment on downtown and college students, you know, in the 1960s when the city fathers and mothers were looking to where to locate UNF. It was authorized in 69. One recommendation was downtown.
Oh, really?
And you know, you would have had 20,000 people coming and going. You know, you'd have 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 people living in the downtown. The decision was made to put it in a more, you know, rural suburban setting. I think it's a gorgeous campus, but I think Daniel's right. There's an energy that comes with young people. FSCJ is making a big bet on it. Both UNF and JU are moving some offices downtown. It's not the same as having dorms and those kinds of things, but that may still come.
And if you're just tuning in, as we speak with John Delaney and Daniel Cronrath about the mayor's budget priorities for Jacksonville, we're talking about public safety and downtown development. What are your thoughts about more money going toward the Cure Violence Initiative, the Kids Hope Alliance, money for downtown, and more? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Okay. The mayor says the increase in property values and tax revenues have allowed the city budget to get bigger without raising taxes.
That's right. I mean, our millage is going to be remaining the same if you're a homeowner here in Jacksonville. And I think what you're saying is you're seeing Jacksonville, which is benefiting right now from a robust national economy. You know, the America as a whole is doing well, and many, many city governments and many state governments across the country are feeling the windfall from our national economy doing well. I think, you know, the other thing, there are winners in this budget. You know, one thing I would like to also point out, you know, in one of our neighborhoods is the Norman Studios project, something that the city mm-hmm. acquired, you know, what, back 2000, 2001, which is finally, this will be, while every mayor that we've had in recent years has contributed to the project, you know, now Mayor Curry is going to be on board with that too, investing another $1 million. And for folks who don't know about it, you know, not every day does a city get an opportunity to add a new national park and to its inventory, which is essentially what we have now. When the studios is completed, the folks in Arlington, a neighborhood which desperately needs redevelopment, would need an inflow of cash, is going to be able to have a national park in its backyard, attracting people there in this budget. So, you know, I think if you go through the budget and look at some of the things, there are nuggets in yeah. this budget, which have been done by Mayor Curry, which I think he deserves some accolades for.
The Norman Studios, a lot of people don't realize they should go visit the studios because the film industry began in Jacksonville
yeah,
before it
yeah.
ever went to California, and yeah, you can learn about it there.
I was going to say that. That's exactly right. And the city fathers ran it out of Jacksonville because they didn't like what the actors and actresses were doing off hours. And Norman Studios was one of the early ones to do that. And then you go beyond that, it was one of the early places for African-American film production. And that was all based in Jacksonville. If I can go back, the economy, there's no question that's a positive. But the mayor mentioned this multiple times. I'm going to sound like a booster. I try never to criticize a mayor if I can. But in this case, these are very sincere. The pension reform that he did is what really freed up huge amounts of dollars. It's mm-hmm. not just the economy. And that was a major, major lift that a substantial portion of this budget would have had to go to fill the pension hole that largely came about because of the recession in 08. And so that's what's really freed the dollars up. He referenced that multiple times. And I think we're forgetting that already. That was a huge deal. And it won, I think, 2/3 of the voters approved the plan. And that's going to be one of his legacies, whether he wants that one to be or not. But that helps a lot.
Right.
And he got that through, took a lot of political capital, as you said. At the same time, there's been some criticism of that deal. What are your thoughts about that?
Right. And that's been from folks. And you know, I think that John makes a great point. Right now, we're seeing the benefit in our annual budget of having this money freed up. The detractors would say, Melissa, as you said, we're also going to be locked into this till 2060. You know, you're not going to just have your children. You're going to have your children's children paying for our police and fire pension issues, because I think a lot of folks have said that even though they like the idea of the sales tax, there wasn't enough money put up front to help pay down some of that repay time.
And that's the criticism.
Yeah.
The problem is there was no other politically viable alternative. The legislature was not going to authorize a pension tax unless it went into place when, in this case, the Better Jacksonville plan expired. There's no way for councils to commit property tax money to go through it. So the pragmatics are, this was the best possible political solution, and it still required a referendum and the creation of a new law over in Tallahassee. It is a huge lift for Jacksonville.
Sure, sure. And let me just add by saying this. There may be folks who aren't completely satisfied with the solution, but to give this mayor credit, he is the one who came up with the solution. He is mm-hmm. the one who took an unpopular topic, which a lot of previous administrations did not want to deal with for good reason, because it's ugly. It's, again, this is not sexy stuff when you basically mm-hmm. have to go to the taxpayer and say, hey, by the way, we need to pay back our obligations from 20 or 30 years ago. You know, how are we going to do this? And this mayor did it.
What about another option that this mayor chose not to do and previous mayors have chosen not to do, which is raise the millage rate in Jacksonville, which some observers think is artificially low?
Couldn't go to pension year after year. It's only a one-year thing. You can never obligate future administrations.
But it could pay for a lot of other priorities.
Well, it's a totally different question than the pension. And that's, you know, that's a political science debate. Do you want higher taxes?
Nobody wants them.
Yeah. I think also most politicians want to be reelected too, Melissa.
Exactly.
And I think in Taxonville,
Jacksonville, we're the opposite of Jacksonville.
Oh, my goodness. I think I just, yeah. But in Jacksonville, you know, if you want to see public office again, you know.
Sure. But at a certain point, you know, whether we're talking about the situation with the Duval County Public Schools and their controversy over trying to raise money to shore up school buildings or any number of other matters, you know, for years now, people that have compared the way this city pays for things to other comparably sized cities have accused Jacksonville through multiple mayoral administrations of not being willing to invest in itself, not being willing to adequately fund basic services and all the extra things. Do you, either of you, think that's a fair criticism?
He's looking over at me.
I was looking at John.
You were looking at me.
Because as you said, nobody wants to be that unpopular politician that says, look, we just have to do this.
Well, in the 1980s, Mayor Godbold raised taxes several times, and Mayor Austin raised them slightly. During my administration, we cut the property tax rate, but we also were able to reduce the number of workers by a quarter to a third. There literally are different ways to count it. And there wasn't the need back then. And then we added the Better Jacksonville Plan, which was a massive infrastructure investment. And certainly there's not a great mood to raise the property tax rate. The question is, what would you do with it? And the school, of course, that's a completely different entity, tax base, et cetera. And, you know, I think the public is willing to embrace an investment in the schools. They simply want to make sure that it's going to be spent wisely and appropriately and in the right places. And unfortunately, that discussion has to go on as much as anything in the public. But I think there's going to be a resolution to that.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I'm just going to go to a few calls. Tony on the south side. Go ahead, Tony.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Sure.
I married into a family of firefighters, and the renegotiation of the pensions and stuff and some other stuff made me apprehensive about how this administration was going to move forward. But as far as budgets go, I'm kind of optimistic about this. I'm a young millennial, just got married, looking to invest and spend money in my city and more opportunities to go downtown and to be a part of Jacksonville. Sounds great. One of the things that I hear from a lot of people my age is there's nothing to do in Jacksonville, or they don't like some of the stuff, and I just don't see what they're talking about, because I love the city, and I think that the way that this looks could really do well for us. We'll see how it pans out, because obviously in politics nothing ever goes as planned, and things are unpredictable. But I am hopeful.
You know, good. Thanks, Tony.
We beat ourselves up on this. Now, when I went to high school here in the 70s, could say there was nothing to do in Jacksonville. You went downtown. It was completely dead or boarded up. It was porno shops and some retail stores that closed at, you know, say, 6 o'clock. Now you can go to, say, the Times Union Center. There's three performing halls in there. Some nights, all three halls have something. The arena has more events. It's one of the most successful arenas of this size in the entire country. The zoo is a top 10 zoo. There's often things going on in the football stadium. Always you want more, and we'd love to have it concentrated in a downtown. I think that would be a lot of fun, but I think we're on our way. I think we're well on our way. The recession really lost that momentum.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I think as a kid growing up in the Northeast, when the Jaguars came to Jacksonville, I was like, wow, isn't that town that reeks like wood and has waffle houses? Like, I was literally one of those people. But when you look at our city, I think this is a city which got big very, very fast, and that there's been growing pains with that growth. However, we're catching up to it. I agree with John. I think that for the naysayers of the city, I think we have a lot of both assets in terms of our commercial development and things to do, but also our natural assets. Listen, you can't just go and make a Timaquan Preserve like we have. You can't make our beaches. You can't, you know, do those kinds of things.
Make the river.
Yeah, you can't make a river, which, of course, then again, another topic of this budget, Melissa, which I think was omitted, was resiliency. You know, how are we going to be looking at sea level rise?
But we're getting emails about that, too.
Yeah, so blessing and curse of the river there, perhaps.
We'll talk about that in a moment. First, though, we want a few more of your calls. It's 549-2937. Sam is in Jacksonville Beach. Hey, Sam.
Yes, good morning. Yes, the Cure of Violence program, how effective has that been in other cities? And about the funding for that, is it a short-term funding, long-term? What is your take on that?
Sure. And it's a pilot for Jacksonville, Sam. They're going to do a year's worth of funding. I think it's under $1 million for the first year, and see how things go. It has gotten fairly positive reviews in other cities.
Right. Sam, it's kind of a mixed bag. You know, it was probably about 8 or 9 years ago, I got a chance to go to Chicago where the program began, and there it was called Ceasefire Chicago. And you got to see results from the program. You know, you actually got to see one of the reasons that their funding got increased is because a lot of their Trauma One hospitals, which in the case of Jacksonville would be Shands, was actually using some of their budget to actually fund the program, because it was so much more cost beneficial to invest in that kind of cure violence program up front versus treating somebody in the emergency room after they had been shot by gun violence. I'm optimistic for this program. It's been rebadged a little bit over the years. You'll notice that we're not using language like ceasefire anymore. We're using language like cure violence. But at the heart of it, it's basically the same goal. It's to be a violence interrupter, is to get into these neighborhoods with a civilian, not a police presence, and try to move the needle. Now,
treating violent gun violence as a public health crisis.
Which is exactly what it is.
Which is exactly what it is.
So, you need a menu. I mean, there's no magic wand, or, you know, when I go to the doctor sometimes, I say, I just want you to give me a shot and I'm cured. You know, well, sometimes it takes a lot more than that. And so there's increased funding there, funding for technology for police, you know, to help isolate some of the shootings and things like that. It's a, I think we're going to keep doing it. No city's really cured it and or fixed it. But certainly we're moving some money and resources towards it. And I was in a meeting with the sheriff last fall, and he said, I couldn't spend more money if the mayor gave it to me. I couldn't hire more police officers any quicker. Right. So I think certainly the leaders of the community are trying to work hard to make that happen.
And to be clear, not just for cure violence, but in the overall budget, the mayor is calling for more than $70 million in additional funding earmarked for various public right. safety initiatives.
I think John is right on this. I think my mind always goes back to when Mayor Payton began the Jacksonville journey. Mm-hmm. And relative to his own budget, Sheriff Rutherford, now Congressman Rutherford at the time, said, listen, Jacksonville's in a situation that we cannot arrest our way solely out of this problem. So to hear somebody who is at the end, like John Rutherford at the time, saying, yes, we need technology, but guess what? We also need to be getting into the crime prevention business. I would love very much not to need so many officers if we had a city that wasn't as violent as it was.
Yeah, the arrest is after the crime.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Right. I remember him talking about the pie, prevention, intervention, and enforcement.
Right, right.
And so with the Jacksonville journey, which unfortunately has lost a lot of funding, it was focused on prevention and intervention. With cure violence, the city's trying something different. Well, we'll have to see how that goes. But in the meantime, let's take a few more calls as we speak with John Delaney and Daniel Cronrath about the budget priorities the mayor's unveiled for Jacksonville, public safety and downtown development in particular. We'll go to your emails and tweets in a moment. Jason is in San Marco. Hi, Jason. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa and in-studio guests. Hey, you know, I've been, I first came up to Jacksonville in the mid-90s. I lived in South Florida, and then I moved here in 2006. So I've been here about 13 years. I want to know if you guys, what do you attribute? Because I have lived in every waterfront community in Florida, and our downtown waterfront is a depressing place to go. From the shipyards over to the site of the district, which so far not one shovel's been turned over there. What do they attribute the failure of this city and this community to attract quality developers to build our waterfront into a world-class place where people want to be and come and spend money and live? What do they attribute the failure of that to?
I think that's a very fair question. And when you go to other cities that have water running through the middle of them, they've done a better job, frankly, of developing them than Jacksonville has. I mean, if you go to San Antonio, Texas, there's a little creek that runs through the middle of it. And they have this incredible river walk built up all around. I mean,
big city, old city. Jacksonville was a middle-sized city. And I think really the characterization is wrong. If you start down at the Cummer, you move up to Fidelity, you've got a river walk that extends all the way across there, the Haskell Building, the old St. Joe Building.
Well, sure, but what I'm talking about is restaurants, bars, attractions, like actual density along the waterfront.
Well,
we don't have that.
And that's coming. And you've got to have residential first. Retail follows residential. And you've got the you know, the Cowford Place that's opened up that's always slammed whenever I've gone in there. And so there's an appetite for it, and I think it's going to come. The shipyards has had a series of false starts. There's no question that. But keep in mind, it was an operating shipyard not that long ago. And Jacksonville's waterfront from the Main Street Bridge down to the stadium was basically rotten wooden wharfs. That's the reason the city and the state started putting buildings on the waterfront. The Adams Mark Hotel, which is now the Hyatt, that's one of the larger hotels in the country, and that's on the waterfront. So some of it is a little bit of patience, and I think it's well on the way. And again, you've got a mayor here. One of the flaws is virtually every other mayor has an interest in downtown and every other mayor doesn't. And it's because it isn't politically popular. And this mayor is really betting a legacy on it. Well, and I'm optimistic over the next 5 to 10 years.
That's why the Downtown Investment Authority was created, to transcend different administrations And so we have a new head of the DIA coming in, Lori Boyer, coming off the city council to lead the DIA. Mm-hmm. And she's talked a lot about the need to activate the waterfront more than we've seen.
I agree. You know, to the caller's point, I think one of the other things about Jacksonville, which makes us unique, but I think Jacksonville downtown suffers from it, is that this is a city of neighborhoods. You know, for example, the classic joke, if you live at the beaches, there's no way I'll go over the ditch to do anything, you know. But really, I mean, I think every one of our neighbors has a quote unquote, neighborhoods has a quote unquote ditch. Even, you know, if you live in Mandarin, why would you necessarily leave Mandarin when there's so many great things to do in your neighborhood? Or if you live on the West Side, or if you, you know, if you live in San Marco or Avondale, you know, there's
there's dozens of great restaurants at the beach.
That's right. There's a predilection to stay in the neighborhood you live, enjoy the neighborhood you live. And unless you're somebody coming to Jacksonville from the outside, I mean, I think for a lot of your listeners, I mean, ask yourself, even if there was something in downtown, when was the last time you went downtown for something?
John tweets the show, in my opinion, the biggest challenges facing downtown are our vast patchwork of incomplete revitalization plans and the misconception that downtown is some crime-ridden mess in spite of the actual crime data. We need a strong, solid vision for downtown. Here's an email from JD, who is with the Jackson, our digital partner. He writes, other than one parking garage, there has been no private new building in the North Bank Core since the Adams Mark. All other private investment has taken place in adaptive reuse of older buildings. Under Curry, there has been the most demolition of existing buildings that we've seen in years. Mm. And there's little money in the budget for anything new to be built downtown. Downtown doesn't lack green space. We just don't maintain the green space we have or turn some of our many empty lots into park space. What about that?
Well, I think, you know, yes, to answer that. I mean, I think that that's an accurate analysis of what we've been doing as a city. I think one of the big challenges is with our downtown, when you look at us versus other cities, and I'll you know, we can give this to John. Jacksonville is unique in a way that we actually have two central business districts here in the city. The South Bank, the Deerwood campuses, the Blue Cross. I mean, we literally, when you talk about trying to get people to work, for example, through public transit, when you have kind of a second central business district, which is decentralized, how do you use rail or effective busing to get people there when our downtown became a pariah in the 70s, slowly drained to 60s, 70s, and 80s? Now we're left basically not just fighting to restore our downtown, but our downtown's competing against another entirely less expensive in terms of real estate, other central business district. So there's a unique challenge there, I think, Jacksonville faces that many other cities that snap their fingers overnight or just have political will don't face when they're trying to get their downtown done.
Yeah, office parks kind of destroyed downtown offices. The development of the suburbs really took care of the residential. And then shopping malls took care of the retail. And so now you're seeing a reversal of that. And when you compare, and the chamber does these trips every year and visit these cities, they almost always have serious distinctions between what we have in Jacksonville. San Antonio is a lot bigger. Indianapolis is a lot bigger. And when you're the state capital, when you're maybe the only major city in the state, all those resources tend to flow there. We're kind of fifth on a pecking order.
I don't think there's any question there's been a jumping of leadership's commitment to it.
There's no question of that.
When you bring up these chamber trips, a delegation of dignitaries, business people, they go on these chamber trips to these other cities and they learn about all the amazing things these other cities are doing. And they learn how they did it, why they did it, how they paid for it. This has been going on for years. Then they come back here and we don't do any of it. Why even have these chamber trips if we're not going to implement some of the learnings that they get when they go?
Well, again, you've got to go back a little longer in history. The landing came as a result of a visit to Baltimore to see the festival marketplace there. The conversion.
That's 30 plus years ago.
I'm saying you got to have a little bit of history on it. And you've got a number of them. The convention center with the same thing came out of a chamber trip. I think the concept of the Civic Council came out of a chamber trip. You're not going to get them out of every city. Some of these are just so unique. And Indianapolis has got the state capital. It's got one of the major, I think it's a Fortune 20 company, up Eli Lilly. You've got a campus there. You get all the federal money and the state money. It's really the only major or city of any size in that state. So there's going to be a difference. I think our time is coming. The recession hurt us badly. There's no question of that. And some inconsistent commitments by various mayors. And I'm not, I don't mean to criticize those mayors. They've got other priorities. But I think with what we're seeing here, you've got four more years of a heavy commitment to it. You've got the, this is not well known, but the richest owner in the NFL is Shad Khan. He is the richest since Paul Allen passed away recently. And he's committing big to around that stadium. And so I know we can look at the glasses half full or half empty. I see it as half full on the way up.
Speaking of Lajay, let me throw this in quickly. Here's a tweet from a listener. Although sea level rise adaptation efforts are also going to be free, right? Now, you mentioned that earlier, Daniel.
Yeah.
This is not anything that's heavily focused on in this budget. But over time, as Jacksonville grows and builds up its waterfront and builds up the urban core, that is going to be a factor as well. Mitigation and adaptation efforts.
Sure. Yeah, it's going to be an enormous cost, and it's something which is above my pay grade to figure out exactly how you're going to be able to do it. You know, we're not going to be able to effectively stop the St. John's River from flooding, clearly, or from the Atlantic Ocean from rising. We just need to be focused on new improvements in our neighborhoods and making sure that we're investing in a way that when we are flooded, that we can recover as quickly as possible. You know, the other thing I wanted to say before, just doubling back to a couple of your callers.
Let me jump on that one. I'm betting on science. It's certainly a real problem. I think scientists in this country are going to find a way. Recent article says if you plant X billion trees, that you'll be able to kind of pull some of that carbon in. I'm not being Pollyanna-ish, but I bet on our universities and scientists to trying to help us figure out a way to deal with it.
You planted a million trees in your administration, didn't you, John?
We did, yeah.
Yeah,
you need a few billion, though.
Thank you both so much for sharing your thoughts. It's always good to get your insights, both of you, because I know our listeners really appreciate it. By the way, there is an email for you, John, from Charles. I would like to offer my condolences to John Delaney over the recent loss of his mother.
Yeah, thank you.
And our condolences as well.
Appreciate it.
So, gentlemen, thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
Enjoyed it.
And much more still ahead. Up next.
So I would say within the next 10 years, I would not be surprised if a human steps foot back out onto the surface of the moon.
A new book marks the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. This is First Coast Connect. We'll be right back.
By the time today's babies are 80 years old, the sea is projected to have risen up to 6.6 feet. So what's being done to protect life on the first coast? On ADAPT from WJCT, you'll find stories about adaptation by everyone from the Navy to realtors and the city of Jacksonville. Join us now at adaptflorida.org.
WJCT's Jaguar Season Parking is still available. Be part of the coolest tailgating downtown. Includes paved space, indoor bathroom access. Contact 358-6327 or log on to wjct.org/parking. Reserve your space today.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, 50 years ago this Saturday, Neil Armstrong stepped foot on the moon.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The moon landing happening the night of July 20th, 1969. Anyone who was alive then remembers exactly where they were and what they were doing that night. 50 years on, private space travel to the moon is in our near future. So says author and astronomer David Aguilar. He's the author of 11 children's books on space and the former director of science at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. And in his new book, Luna, The Science and Stories of Our Moon, Aguilar explores the moon from all angles, from its place in the night sky to its role in shaping our history and culture. I spoke with him yesterday. David Aguilar, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
And it's such good timing to be talking to you about your book with the 50th anniversary of the moon landing this weekend. This is an incredible look at the moon like we've never seen it before. Not only will kids enjoy this book, but adults too. What inspired this book for you?
Well, I started out as a young boy building telescopes, looking at the sky, and of course the moon was always the first thing you looked at.
Mm-hmm.
And as a professional astronomer, we kind of neglected it after that. We were looking further away into space, but it's time for me to go back to my roots and do what I enjoyed, and so I decided to write a book on the moon.
You weave together science and myth in this book. We learn all about the science of the moon, but you also debunk some falsehoods about the moon. What are some of the most common myths people hold about the moon?
Well, recently we think the moon influences our lives in odd ways. We also think that maybe during full moons, birth rates go up, more crimes are maybe committed. And actually, the numbers don't show that to be the truth.
Really?
We seem to be doing that all of the time, and the moon doesn't affect us. But the moon does have effects on the Earth. It stabilizes the Earth. We'd be wobbling like a top if we didn't have the moon out there to keep us steady in our orbit, which means we would have wild and crazy weather and tidal waves on the Earth as it whipped around and wobbled. So it does affect us in that way.
Hmm. It's so interesting because I think the belief about the moon being full is common across many cultures. I've even talked to trauma surgeons who work in hospitals and say that they know when the moon is full, they're going to have a busier night than usual. But you're saying that the science doesn't back it up.
It doesn't. But here's what I think, too. When you have a full moon, you have a lot more people out at night, maybe doing crazy things, swimming, you know, jumping off of cliffs and swimming in lakes at midnight. And so consequently, the numbers may bounce a little bit in emergency rooms, but birth rates don't go up, and police records don't show that more crimes take place. But the world at night changes when the full moon is out there. It even casts kind of a blue glow on the ground. It's magical, so mm-hmm. Many people might think it might influence them and change things.
With the 50th anniversary coming up, there will be renewed interest in people just looking at the moon and talking about it. You have some tips in this book for how to use a telescope properly to look at the moon, right?
I did. And what I wanted to do was pick 12 places that if I could go to the moon, I'd want to go see them. Gigantic cliffs, monstrous craters. These are like the Grand Canyons of the Earth that many people want to see. And so I found that with a very small amateur telescope, you can see them from your backyard or front yard or wherever you want to take a look. And then I told you a little bit about each one of these areas, so you kind of feel like you've been there and seen them for yourself.
Hmm. Now, let me ask you as well. You write that it might be possible for people to live on the moon in as soon as 10 years. Really?
Well, we may have colonies because we, again, think United States, but right now, India, postponed a launch to the moon today. They're going. The Chinese have already been there. They're going to the moon. The Russians have been there. The Japanese have been there. We have a lot more, many more countries that want to go to the moon. And now also we have commercial space. So I would say within the next 10 years, I would not be surprised if a human steps foot back out onto the surface of the moon.
And what are your thoughts about the space program in general, particularly how more private industry is stepping up and exploring going into space?
I think this is fantastic. And I know for a while people were really upset when Obama decided he was going to turn some of the missions over to private enterprise. But we've seen this before, and people forget this. The airplane was invented as a military tool. And the Wright brothers and Glenn Curtiss were financed by the military because we were going to use it for observations, we were going to use it later in war. But when the commercial industry came in and took over, suddenly we're flying in airliners. Suddenly we have private airplanes. And that's exactly what's happening with space now. The government has helped develop the bottom line to get going in space exploration, and now private industry is coming along that says we can do it quicker, faster, cheaper, and we'll do it on our nickel. Here we go. And so I applaud it.
And is it something you want to do yourself? Go into space? Uh-oh. You've written a lot of books about space.
I would love to go in space. I dream I'm in outer space. I'm a scuba diver, and I scuba dive at night because, to me, underwater, floating 50 feet underwater is just like being in outer space at night. And that's the closest I'm going to get. But yes, if a flying saucer landed tomorrow in my front yard, I'm going with them.
Well, that begs another question. Do you believe in extraterrestrial life out there?
Well, I certainly believe there is life out there. You can call it extraterrestrial, away from the Earth. Yes, there's going to be planets with life all over them. It may not be what we would recognize as life, nor may it think the way we do or sense the environment or outer space the way we do, but there will be life out there, most certainly.
In the meantime, people do need to pick up your book, especially parents that want to educate their kids about the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. You know, I was 2 years old the night that happened, so I don't remember it. But my brother was four, and what my parents, the story my parents loved to tell is that as they were watching the moon landing live on TV that night, my brother kept running back and forth from the television set to outside on the back patio and looking up at the moon because he figured naturally he would be able to see the astronauts on the moon if he just ran outside and looked up at the sky. So everyone has those memories, I think, of the moon landing. And for young kids today that weren't alive then, your book is a really good resource.
Well, I wanted to bring the vitality back of exploration and discovery and how much it pushes us ahead of the civilization. But I also wanted to take a look at how it affects us here on Earth with the tides, how the moon is part of our history with our legends and our stories and werewolves. And it has impacted us in so many wonderful ways. And I wanted to bring that out in my book.
I'm so glad to speak to you about it at this anniversary week. So, David Aguilar, a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Melissa, it was a pleasure.
Luna, the science and stories of our moon, is in stores now. And up next, we'll tell you how you can download the brand new app Relevant and find your vibe. We'll speak with the app's creator from right here on the First Coast after this.
If you're headed into the great outdoors this summer, you might be fighting crowds.
We're seeing record-breaking visitation at national parks, and millennials are often characterized as a generation that likes to experience things. So camping fits into that.
I'm Amy Scott, the new camping economy, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, here on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Columnist Rich Benjamin says gay men like him are not doing enough to support women's rights, but should be.
What can gay men do to step up our support for women, especially given what they've done for our movement and what they've done for our cause over so many decades?
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Colson Whitehead. His new novel, set in the early 60s, is based on the true story of a notorious Florida reform school where many boys were beaten and sexually abused. Dozens of unmarked graves were discovered on the school grounds. The state shut down the school in 2011. The novel's called The Nickel Boys. Join us. Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
America spends big bucks on video games, including money we did not expect to spend. Some lawmakers propose cracking down on what are known as loot boxes.
I enjoy supporting companies, but there's a point where the things you get in the loot boxes become exploitative.
What do our favorite games really cost? Part 2 of our special series, Game Mode, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, a new national app has launched this month after being developed right here on the First Coast, and it'll help you get relevant. Winder Hughes is the founder and CEO of Relevant Inc., and he's on the line now with more. Hey, Winder, good morning.
Hey there. What's going on?
Hey, congratulations on the launch of Relevant, and that is an app that people can get at the Play Store on their Android or iPhone. It's spelled R-E-L-E-V-N-T. Tell us about it.
Well, that's right. It's spelled the cool way.
That's right.
And pronounce it exactly the same way. But what we are is a location-based messaging network where users connect through local message boards that we call them vibes based on their interest and location. So kind of the value proposition is that it allows people to connect to local chat, content, and culture wherever you are, wherever you go. So for people that are kind of tuned in right now, it's kind of like Nextdoor meets Reddit is kind of the way that we describe it to new people. So that's the essence of it. We're launching here and on the college campus scene, where each school has its own network and a directory of vibes that the students can join in on.
Very cool. So when people travel to other cities, they'll be able to open up Relevant and learn all about everything that's happening in that location, since it's and local content from other places will generate, and they can learn more that way.
That's exactly right. So just like, you know, Yelp and these other things that go with you, we're kind of like the same thing. But I think what we're bringing here to the table that a lot of these older apps like Yelp or Meetup or like a Craigslist really don't bring is that all the content is kind of buried behind their walls. And so with Relevant, local businesses, local creators, whatnot, they have a more kind of like engaging, outgoing way of connecting with users.
Right. And a full disclosure, I contributed a little bit to Relevant, some interviews with interesting people all over town that we shot on rooftop bars all over the city. It's a web series called Getting High with Melissa Ross. That's going to launch later this week. Pretty excited about that.
Yeah.
And so that's one example of local content you'll be featuring on Relevant. As you roll this out, what is your big vision for the growth of this app? Because, you know, the app development is competitive. It's exciting at the same time. And so what's your long-term vision for Relevant?
So you know, I mean, like all startups, it's been a long journey, a lot of pivots, because, you know, there's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, LinkedIn, and we were trying to, you know, find our opening. And I think when we finally found this location-based way for people to connect, engage in all new ways, you know, that's, we think that's a big idea. And again, you see Nextdoor kind of blow up, but it, although it's functional, it's just not cool. It's not aimed at like a younger audience. And so we're just going to be that new thing that happens. That's kind of like the big vision. And we're very excited about this new feature that's coming tomorrow called Events. And you may think that's a picked over kind of thing, but when you look at it, you know, you find Events is a very fragmented, messy, inconsistent space for everybody. You got to go to, like, you know, all these sites to find stuff. So with Relevant, is all going to be in one place, in one app, and we just think that's going to be like the big driver for users.
It's free too, by the way. People can download the Relevant app anytime. A new updated version is available for both iPhone and Android. So Winder Hughes, founder and CEO of Relevant Inc., kudos to you and much success. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And for all those, you can also set up your own Vibe as well. So it's very, you know, user friendly and whatnot.
And we'll
thank
be,
you.
Thank you. We'll be following it. And thanks so much for listening this morning. That's our show. Our producer is the scintillating Heather Schatz. The serene and majestic Michelle Corum is our show director. And we always want your feedback. Send your comments and thoughts to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, the latest on all things cannabis-related here in Florida. That's tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8, keep listening for the Electro Lounge. And make sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. See you then. This is how I want to live. Gonna lay me down in love. I got so much more to give. Starry, starry night. This is how I want to live. Gonna lay me down in love. I got so much more to give. Tonight.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.